Our second case this morning is United States v. Anderson. Captain Freitas, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
I am, Your Honor.
Major Kramer, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Cox, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Julia Freitas, and I, along with my co-counsel, Major Rachel Gordienko, represent the appellant, Private Xavier Anderson. Tolerating the delay in this case would adversely affect the public's perception of the military justice system. The delay was extreme, it was unjustified, and it has gone unexplained. Despite appellant asserting his right to speedy post-trial processing on three separate occasions, the government failed for 481 days to timely process the post-trial matters in this case. Appellant first asserted his right over a year after sentencing. He was sentenced on September 6, 2018. On September 30, 2019, appellant asserted his right to speedy post-trial processing. However, it went ignored by the government. Appellant asserted his right again on November 5, 2019, and again, it went ignored by the government. Appellant asserted his right for a third time on December 9, 2019, and again, it went ignored. For 481 days, the government sat on appellant's case while he languished in confinement. 152 days of that delay, more than what is reasonable and has been set to be reasonable by this court, was spent for the government to transcribe and compile the record. And then appellant's case languished for 298 days for the military judge to complete seven lines of errata. Now, the government has offered no explanation. They did not offer an explanation to the convening authority prior to the convening authority taking action. They did not offer an explanation to the Army Court when this was briefed at the lower court. And again, they have not offered any evidence in terms of an explanation to this court. Because of that, because of the egregious nature, because of the lack of the explanation, because of the three assertions by appellant, appellant is asking for the findings and sentence of his case to be set aside and for the case to be dismissed.
Captain Freitas, can I ask you a question from your brief? Is it your position that if an appellant merely shows that the post-trial processing was not completed until after the appellant was first eligible for parole, that that is sufficient to show prejudice?
No, Your Honor, that is not my position. I would first state that the Barker v. Wingo factors and prejudice in the Barker v. Wingo factors, it's a balancing test. No factor is dispositive. However, as it relates to prejudice and the request, rather the missed opportunity for parole, in this case, it went towards the particularized anxiety that was being experienced by appellant. His particularized anxiety was more than what was being experienced by other prisoners because he had missed the opportunity for parole. That should have occurred in August of 2019. We know that he's experiencing anxiety because he asserts his constitutional right after that missed opportunity. This court has held on numerous occasions.
So why then aren't you saying that, in fact, what I just posited is true? If you're saying, well, he was experiencing particularized anxiety because of the fact that he missed that first opportunity, so why does that not indicate that your argument is, if you miss that first opportunity, then prejudice is shown?
Well, that would certainly be great for the defense bar if that was the ruling that this court would make. However, because of this court's precedent, it is very possible that an appellant would miss an opportunity for parole and simply not care, simply not assert his right to speedy trial, speedy post-trial processing. However, that's not the case.
Sounds like you're setting up an ineffective assistance of counsel claim there.
Well, not in this particular case.
No, but in terms of those scenarios.
I would certainly think that it would be ineffective for a defense counsel not to assert an appellant's or a client's constitutional rights once they realize that those rights were being violated, which happened here, which is why it's so egregious after appellant asserted his rights on three separate occasions, which shows his particularized anxiety, which is one of the factors to be considered when determining whether there was actual prejudice, which there was in this case.
But in terms of particularized anxiety, the appellant here, he was not incarcerated. He was being paid, I'm sorry, he was not reduced in rank. He was permitted to be paid at the proper rate and so forth, even though he still had some jump master duties that were restricted. Am I bleeding over into the prior case? Sorry. No wonder you had that confused look. I should have had the confused look.
I assumed that you knew more about my client than I did, sir, so
no.
I was just going to roll with it.
One hopes that that's not the case. So then, why isn't this ability to be eligible for parole too speculative as a basis for being able to show that there is prejudice here?
It's because of the assertions of appellant's rights and the reasons why he gave as to why he was asserting those rights that demonstrate the particularized anxiety and concern. In his request to have his speedy post-trial rights honored, he states very clearly, one, that he had a reasonable claim of a factual and legal sufficiency argument that he planned to raise once his appeal reached the Army Court. He also stated very clearly, and it's cited in Joint Appendix page 18, that he was missing a parole opportunity because of that. The government ignored that request. They did not honor his post-trial speedy trial, his post-speedy trial right at that point. It goes to show the particularized anxiety. Whether or not the appellant would get parole is a speculation. I concede that point. However, there is actual prejudice here because of the anxiety and concern that was caused because he was languishing and his rights and pleas were going unanswered. If you put yourself in the mindset of Private Anderson, he's sitting in confinement. Over 365 days have passed since his sentence was announced. He knows that he has a right to speedy post-trial processing. He asserts that right through his trial defense counsel, and that goes unanswered. His pleas go ignored by the government. Not only do they go ignored directly to Private Anderson, they go ignored to the convening authority. They then go ignored to the Army Court. The egregiousness of the lack of action by the government is one of the things that makes this case unique and one of the reasons why this appellant should be granted relief.
Captain Farinas, during the time that the case is with the military judge and the military judge is reviewing it, preparing to authenticate, the accused made his demand for a speedy appellate review, but the government didn't really just ignore him. They kind of said, hey, look, no, the military judge has it. Is that what happened?
That is, Your Honor, what happened.
So what would, and I'm asking genuinely because I'm not sure how it works in the Army, but what would or what could the SJA or whomever do at that point? What does someone do? Go to the military judge and say, hey, speed it up, bud, or madam? What's supposed to happen at this point?
Your Honor, the Army Court has given guidance to the field. They did so in a case, United States v. Frame, which is included in the Joint Appendix page 71, where the Army Court said that the OSJA has a duty. They can go to the circuit judge, the chief circuit judge. They can go to the chief of the trial judiciary. And I would also cite that it's difficult to speculate as to what the government could have done because they offer no explanation. They offer no evidence as to why there was such a delay.
So even if they did do that in this case, there's no way to know it because there's no indication in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no indication in the record as to why it languished with the military judge. The government has argued only through assertion, really, in their brief that Fort Bliss is a busy jurisdiction. However, they offer no evidence of how many cases were going on, how many cases that military judge was assigned to. All information that is could easily be gleaned from logging on to the electronic docket and pulling that information or searching through EDNs from that jurisdiction. All of that information is squarely within the government's control. However, they could not even be inconvenienced to find that information and present it to the court. That goes towards the adverse effect on the public's perception of the military justice system, that lack of explanation, that lack of evidence.
Can you address this point for me as well? You're kind of asserting prejudice in two ways, the traditional Barker prejudice, so to speak, and that would deal with your client's ability to receive clemency or time off, I mean a shortened time period, early release. And you're also alleging a broader kind of claim under Moreno, which is a due process claim, that this period of time is so egregious that it would be perceived by the public. It would give the public an unfavorable view of the military justice system. Is that right? Can you focus for just a minute on that last part? Because I don't know what you're comparing it to or what to compare it to.
Yes, Your Honor. So I would call the second claim of prejudice Toohey prejudice. Mm-hmm. Under United States v. Toohey, this court held that if a delay is so egregious as to adversely affect the public's perception, that essentially satisfied the fourth prong of the Barker v. Wingo test, even if there wasn't actualized prejudice for a specific appellant. The egregiousness of this delay in this case is, one, the time. Now, the government says that 481 days is not unreasonable. However, not only did this court state that it was unreasonable under U.S. v. Moreno, it is unreasonable because of the standards in the military. In our supplemental citation that we offered to this court, we cited the statistics, as we did in our reply brief, about the other services. And the Air Force and the Navy have a significantly lower rate of post-trial delay issues than the Army. It is an Army problem. The post-trial delay processing issue is an Army problem. 481 days should never be seen as reasonable, not only because of the precedent of this court, but because of societal standards within the military and across the branches. I would also state that it is particularly egregious in this case because of the three assertions by appellant to have his rights vindicated, to have his rights respected. And while the government offered a two-line email response saying it's with the military judge, they offered no additional evidence about what they were doing to help rectify that problem. They offered no timeline saying that we hope that it will be completed by the new year. We understand your client's issue regarding parole. They offered none of that. They also did not offer any of that information to the convening authority so that he might offer some sort of relief to appellant. They denied the convening authority that opportunity and appellant that opportunity. All of that in conjunction make this case particularly egregious and downright embarrassing to the United States Army and the military justice system. As the Supreme Court has stated, speedy post-trial processing is something that has been incorporated into the civilian courts through Federal Criminal Procedure, Rule 32. And it now has been incorporated into Article 66, a requirement of timely post-trial processing. This is clearly something that the public cares about. Our system is built to be efficient and to be conducted with speed. And that was not done here.
Now, in terms of the public's perception of the fairness, to what extent, if at all, should this court consider the person responsible for the delay? In other words, if you get this hypothetical member of the public and has that person has some understanding of the military justice system and says, okay, the court reporter who works for the SJA isn't getting his or her act together, or there's delay with the convening authority or so forth, that's one thing. But the issue of a military judge who is presumed to be neutral and detached, that's another. Should we consider that in terms of the public's perception of fairness or not?
You should consider that in public's perception of fairness, but it should weigh heavily in appellant's favor. The government is the government is the government. The public is aware of that. The public would be aware, if they had any idea of the military justice system, that the government staffs the trial judiciary, that TJAG is responsible for not only the caseload of defense counsel, but for the caseload of the trial judiciary. This is also something that this court has already ruled on. In U.S. v. Arriaga and subsequent case law after U.S. v. Moreno, the obligation to ensure timely review and action by the convening authority rests squarely on the shoulders of the government. That includes any delay created by the military judge. Also, uniquely in this case, the government had exceeded a reasonable timeline prior to the record even making it to the military judge. It was 152 days for transcription and compiling of the record. That in and of itself is unreasonable. Now, while the government says 152 days, It's only 32 days over the Moreno clock, so not too bad. That's reasonable. But they don't take into consideration that the military judge was going to take some amount of time to review the record. They also don't take into account that there was an additional time for after the military judge completed his 7 lines of errata, right, for the court to get, for the record to make it to the Army Court, which is an additional 32 days. All of that timeline together is unreasonable. So while the public may...
Can you clarify one thing? What is the relief you're seeking?
Yes, Your Honor. We are seeking that the findings and sentence be set aside and that the case against the appellant be dismissed with prejudice.
Counsel, in your opening brief, you just said appropriate relief, and now you're specifying that this is the appropriate relief. Why is that the appropriate relief, that dismissing the charges with prejudice?
It is the appropriate relief, one, because this is a constitutional violation. And constitutional violations have to have some ramification. In our initial brief, we asserted appropriate relief. We are now saying dismissal because of the continued lack of explanation by the government, because of the fact that they somehow think that 481 days is reasonable, because of the need for a deterrent effect on the field to somehow wrangle the Army to respect the constitutional rights of appellants. This court noted in footnote 22 of U.S. v. Moreno that there is value in a deterrent effect, much like the exclusionary clause offers a deterrent effect for violations of the Fourth Amendment. That is what is needed here. This court has done this before to send, it has taken bold action to send messages to the field. It's also needed, Your Honor, because there is no other meaningful relief available. The appellant has served his entire time of confinement, and he did so without the benefit, really, of having an appeal. He did so without having the benefit of having that automatic look. We can't get those days back. So the only real meaningful relief left is dismissal.
Captain Ferenc, can I ask you what your client actually served? Was, did he get the opportunity to get a good time added to a sentence? I think in this case, that's probably about a third of his sentence, right?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired, if I can answer your question.
Sure. And I'm wondering, I mean, I'm taking your time, but if that's a third of his sentence, and I'm guessing, but then that means he served a year, right, of his 3-year sentence?
No, Your Honor, he served significantly more than a year. He was released in June 17th of 2021. He did receive some good time credit. Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to 38 months. He had 141 days of pretrial confinement time that was credited towards his sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So while he did receive the traditional 5 days per month of time served if he did not have any disciplinary violations, also a few abatement days if he attended certain classes, he did receive that time, Your Honor. However, that's because of his good behavior while in confinement. I certainly wouldn't consider that, and I'm not aware of any precedent from this court that considers that to be any form of clemency or relief to be considered when the government has violated someone's constitutional rights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I have one question. What is the, I assume it's a rule or a regulation that would have prevented appellant from seeking parole, even though the convening authority hadn't approved the adjudged sentence at that point, knowing that his sentence would be at what his potential maximum sentence would have been, I assume his trial defense counsel would have known that he would have been eligible, assuming he was going to get the full sentence. What is it? Is it a rule? Is it a regulation? What prevented trial counsel from just saying, we don't have it yet, but we're going to apply anyway?
Yes, Your Honor. It's U.S. Department of Army Regulation 15-130, which is the regulation for Army Clemency and Parole Board, Para 3-1, subsection C. It's on page 6 of our reply brief in footnote 2. It's also on Joint Appendix page 61 is the specific regulation that states that until a record of trial is received, an appellant is not available or is not eligible to be considered for parole. And it's not just the record of trial, it's specifically the convening authority action, which obviously cannot be taken under those rules until after the errata is complete. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel?
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Cox, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Brett Kramer, and I, along with Captain Melissa Eisenberg, represent the government in this case. This court should affirm the Army Corps' decision for the following three reasons. First, there is no due process violation. Applying the Barker factors to this case, it's clear that the appellant suffered no prejudice from the delay. Based on there being no merit to appellant's substantive appeal, it can be concluded that there was no oppressive incarceration pending appeal, and there has been no impairment of the ability to present a defense at rehearing. Further, there's nothing in the record to indicate any particularized anxiety or concern that is distinguishable from the normal anxiety experienced by prisoners awaiting an appellate decision. Second, in balancing the other three Barker factors, the delay is not so egregious that tolerating it would adversely affect the public's perception of fairness and integrity in the military justice system. And third, assuming arguendo that this court finds a due process violation, the record's complete absence of any prejudice demonstrates that the constitutional error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Turning first to prejudice, appellant's claims of prejudice are unavailing. While appellant argues that prejudice based on a delayed clemency and parole hearing, there's nothing in the record to support the proposition that appellant would have been granted clemency or parole. As has been held by this court consistently, in order to prevail on questions of prejudice, the record must specifically identify how he, the appellant, was prejudiced due to the delay. Mere speculation is not enough. That's Moreno and Gosser.
So in a scenario such as this, and I would assume that a lot of cases fit essentially into this basket, is it the government's position that an accused has a right to timely post-trial processing, but doesn't have the ability to enforce that right?
Yes, Your Honor. They have the right to timely post-trial processing, and then once you...
But they have you're saying they have no remedy. They have no ability to, in fact, enforce that right.
They do, Your Honor, when they can show prejudice. So adding further refinement to this exact question, the Army Court found in U.S. v. Ney...
But that's the premise of my point. I'm saying, in cases such as this, you're saying, wasn't provided clemency first time around, or parole, that therefore in these scenarios there is this right, but it's unenforceable by an accused.
Yes, Your Honor, it is enforceable when the hearing actually takes place. And the government proffers that this appellant did in fact have a clemency and parole hearing, was denied twice after this. And, of course, with the court's permission, the government will provide supplemental on that.
On that specific point about providing supplemental, can we consider any of that? That's not part of the record, is it?
No, Your Honor, that would be your decision to accept that as part of the record, this court's decision. However, it does exist.
And this presents a somewhat a problem, which is that with post-trial processing delay, all the prejudice that would occur would seem to be after the record is, wouldn't be reflected in the record. And so if we say you can only get relief if you show prejudice, and the prejudice has to be shown in the record, well, how's it going to be in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. So the requirement that an appellant demonstrate prejudice is not a unique requirement, and that's a quote from footnote 18 of Moreno, which is also looking at Chapman, Moulton, and, of course, Strickland v. Washington, which requires the defendant to show counsel's deficient performance. The utter lack, the complete lack of any type of prejudice shown in the record is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that there is no prejudice, Your Honor. It would have, of course, been presented in a brief. Now, moving along with prejudice.
Major Kramer, before you get to your next point on prejudice, what are we to make of this lack of any reasons at all attending the court reporter's delay and the delay concerning the military judge? I mean, it's just out there. It's a number. And defense counsel's position is that, hey, look, my client wanted this addressed early on and got no response from the government, or no substantive response from the government. What are we to make of that? And the only reason why I ask is because if that doesn't go to the actual prejudice required under Tui and Moreno, then isn't that something we should include in our or consider in our consideration of whether this is due process egregiousness?
Yes, Your Honor. So you're turning to the public perception of fairness and integrity in the military justice system. And essentially, the government's position is that there actually is proof in the record that there was care and concern by the government. On JA-19, the email correspondence between the Chief of Justice and Defense Counsel shows that the Chief of Justice was engaged, at least on one occasion, and likely more, can be inferred more, with the judiciary through the clerk of court of the Army Court to resolve this issue. So as far as the care and concern, of course, every time that when they implied that there was a delay or requested speedy trial relief on day 389, by the way, it was responded to saying that we are monitoring this. It was on the top of the agenda of the Chief of Justice, it can be inferred. They're monitoring the fact that this is a delay. And then with regard to what did they do, well, they clearly had reached out to the clerk of court for assistance in this case, Your Honor.
I see. And so the government seems to be taking the position, hey, look, that's all we can do with respect to the military judge. We can only go to his boss or his boss's boss or whomever.
Your Honor, I think that the view that you take towards the judicial delay is important in this case. So the Navy Marine Corps and USB CONSUC basically said, you know, if this court views the goal as examining what caused the delay from adjournment to convening authority action, then the delay is explained. And that it's the military judge held the case for 298 days. Now, why that is doesn't necessarily need to be explained. It is explainable delay in that the judge held it for too long. And the government's position is that it is disappointing that it took this long. However,
you're saying it's irrelevant as to why the military judge may have held it that long? What if he's out, you know, fishing or something? I don't know.
Yes, Your Honor. We just have nothing in the record to explain.
That's my point. I think that's counsel's defense counsel's point. There's nothing in there to show why this is reasonable.
Sure.
So, and it seems that a reason cited by someone would be enough to confront or at least counter a claim that, hey, this is an unreasonable amount of time for the military judge to be reviewing this case.
Well, it's certainly a factor under the Barker factors that is in favor of the appellant here. However, as provided in TUI, even if the court does not find actual prejudice under the fourth Barker factor, then when balancing the other three factors, the delay due process violation can be found. When in balancing the other three factors, the delay is so egregious that tolerating it would adversely affect the public's perception. So if we're conducting that analysis and looking at the other three factors, we, of course, look to factor one, the length of delay. That's in favor of the appellant. Now we look at factor two, the reason for delay. And the record indicates that it's with the judge. As far as did the government not care and just let it go? No, the record reflects that the government did care and actually engage with the judiciary to try to get this across the finish line. And then you look to factor three, the appellant's assertion of the right of timely appeal, and that's 389 days into the process. And, of course, in Gosser, this court said that appellant's silence on speedy trial militates against the claim. So it's still in their favor, but it's a mitigating circumstance that they waited until this length of time. So,
Kramer?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you address the remedy that appellant wants, setting aside the findings and sentence and dismissing the charges with prejudice? Is that, if we were to agree that there was a violation here, would that be the appropriate remedy?
Your Honor, of course, if you did agree that there's a due process violation, then the government has a burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless. In this case, there is absolutely nothing in the record to reflect any amount of harm.
But
getting past that, yes, Your Honor.
But getting past that, is this the appropriate relief?
No, Your Honor. This is a nuclear option that's not appropriate when there's conventional options that still exist. And those options are laid out in Moreno itself. So a day-for-day reduction in confinement, for example, reduction of forfeitures. Your Honor, there are options available. Furthermore, as provided in the supplemental, or not the supplemental, but the brief by appellant, the lower court, the Army Court, is taking appropriate action, too. Multiple cases were listed where 66C credit was being given for delays. So this isn't something that the Army doesn't take seriously. It's unfortunate. It's certainly not preferred, but action is being taken to remedy it.
So in terms of concrete remedy for this particular appellant, what would the appellant walk away with here as a remedy?
Based on absolutely no prejudice and no evidence of prejudice in the record, there is no remedy, Your Honor.
No, I'm assuming, as Judge Maggs did, that we were to find that there was prejudice. If we were to determine that the appellant should prevail on its legal arguments, what is the concrete benefit that this court can confer here?
Your Honor, some sort of sentence reduction that would result in some type of recovery of forfeitures would probably be the appropriate remedy in the government's opinions, Your Honor.
So you're saying put money back in his pocket?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the only thing appropriate when, if you do find that there's prejudice, so little prejudice exists. Certainly going beyond and dismissing charges or setting aside, that's a nuclear option, Your Honor, which would not be in the interest of justice. Now, moving to error beyond a reasonable doubt, the constitutional error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in this case. Assuming that the court finds this due process violation, the record demonstrates that the unconstitutional error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Quite simply, the record is bereft of any evidence of prejudice. The result in U.S. v. Bush, which is this court's case, is revealing in that this case was where there was no evidence of prejudice stemming from the constitutional error based on public perception. In Bush, it took over 7 years between the end of trial and the docketing with the CCA. However, in reviewing the totality of the circumstances, de novo, this court concluded that the due process violation was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And under the totality of the circumstances in this record, the court can be confident that any due process violation was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So just like Bush, this court should find any constitutional error that is found harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Your Honor.
Let me ask you this. In Bush, did the accused or the appellant get a longer sentence? Wasn't there a greater sentence involved there?
Your Honor, I actually do not have the information at my fingertips right now. I'm happy to with the court's permission, to provide a supplemental brief on that.
No, not necessary. I have a poison pen carrying law clerk back there who can find out.
Yes, Your Honor, essentially in the key cases like Moreno, Toohey, Bush, Gosser, when there was a due process found, there was substantive error found, like in Moreno. There was substantive error found in Toohey. When it was merely public perception, like in Bush and Gosser, there was public perception was found. However, it was error proved harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in both cases, and therefore no relief was provided.
Major Kramer, I thought this horse was dead, but I just thought about another question on this. So I'm going to take another swing at him here.
Yes, Your Honor.
And this is the question you and I were just talking about earlier about the reasons not given for the military judge's delay. And so I'm wondering if the government's position is this, that, hey, when the government does everything it can do, alerting the military judge, alerting his boss, his boss's boss, and there is still an unexplained delay, doesn't the accused suffer as much from unexplained delay caused by the judiciary as it does delay caused by anyone else?
If there is prejudice, yes, Your Honor. In this case, there is absolutely no evidence of prejudice.
So no matter how long or how unexplained any particular part of the delay is, there's simply no prejudice.
No, Your Honor, it's the government's position that eventually there would be prejudice.
Yeah, at what point do you get there?
When you can show prejudice. For example, when you do go out to apply for a job after you're out and you can't provide the DD-214 that would allow for you to get that job, and you provide affidavits from those potential employers that say he either would have seriously been considered for this job or he outright would have gotten the job, which is the case in jurisprudence. Right?
And the government's position here is that, hey, look, whatever prejudice there was being claimed here is simply too speculative.
Yes, Your Honor.
Actual prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's a government's claim, but that's also the claim of case law, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. It needs to be more than just speculative, and it just plain does not exist in this case, Your Honor.
I understand.
Counsel, out of curiosity, does an appellant or someone similarly situated in confinement have access to any legal assistance or anything to go to the Court of Criminal Appeals to get an extraordinary writ, to order the judge to certify the record or anything like that?
I'm unaware of the answer to that question, Your Honor.
He was kind of on his own requesting?
Well, he had appellate representation, which, of course, according to appellate counsel, part of the reason that the appellate's attorney reached out to the Chief of Justice was because he missed his clemency and parole hearing. So there, based on the record and what we have, it does seem that there was communication between his attorney back at Fort Bliss and himself in
Kentucky. His defense counsel at trial, that attorney?
Yes, Your Honor. For these reasons, this court should affirm the Army Corps' decision. Any of your questions?
Thank you.
Your Honor, I just want to make a few points to follow up on some of the things that the government said. First, as it relates to the email correspondence and the explanations that the government would like to state that show that the government was on the case, that they were working it. If you look at the joint appendix, you'll see very clearly that the Chief of Justice says we're monitoring the situation. In other words, the government is monitoring the constitutional violation of appellant's rights. It doesn't say we're doing something. It doesn't say we've contacted the military judge to see where the errata is at. It doesn't say we've contacted the trial judiciary. It doesn't say we've contacted the Chief Circuit Judge. It doesn't say we've offered the military judge additional support. It doesn't say that they took any action other than monitoring the constitutional violation of appellant's rights. Constitutional rights have meaning, and the deprivation of those rights has to have ramifications. As Your Honor mentioned, there is no enforcement mechanism that the government wants to say exists for a violation of an appellant's speedy post-trial rights. This court is the watchdog. This court is the enforcer, has to be the enforcer of that constitutional right for appellant. Because while the Army Court has offered some tardive relief in approximately 14 cases that we cited in our reply brief, as you'll also see from the supplement that we provided, there is over 191 Army cases where there was a post-trial processing issue. The Army Court has not offered 191 circumstances of tardive relief. They are not remedying the problem. I would also like to state that it is the government's burden to show that the prejudice was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. While the court has found, well, that might be easier if there is not an actualized prejudice shown by appellant. Appellant has shown a prejudice in this case. Government may disagree. I find it somewhat laughable that government counsel argues that if appellant would have shown that he was denied employment, that might be prejudice. Because I am certain and have seen in case law that they would have argued that was not particularized prejudice, that was speculative in and of itself as well. It is the government's burden to show, just as they would have had the burden to show at trial, beyond a reasonable doubt, it is not the appellant's duty to present evidence that the constitutional violation was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I know you have a few seconds here left, but what would you have expected the government to do once they were notified of your client's claim for speedy appellate review? And suppose, unlike in this case, from your position, suppose they had come back to you or the defense counsel at the time and said, hey, look, the military judge has this case. We've sent several notices to him or her. We've gotten no response. We've talked to the chief trial judge. We've called up and even asked the JAG to step in. And still nothing from the local judiciary. What would you expect to happen at that point? In other words, once the government comes back to you and says, we've exhausted all the efforts we can conjure up here, what next?
That would be for this court to decide. We would expect the government to do something. We would expect the government to do anything. They did not do anything in this case, at least not what is evident in the record. I see that my time has expired, if I may briefly, Your Honor, finish.
May I ask one last question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you respond to the government's statement that if there was a reduction in the sentence as a relief, that would provide some relief in terms of return of forfeited pay? Do you agree with that statement?
No, Your Honor, I don't. Appellant hit his ETS date while in confinement. Whether or not he would receive any funds because he was given day-for-day credit is speculative, and is not supported by any evidence that the government has offered that that would actually provide any amount of relief. He can't unserve time in confinement. A day-for-day credit wouldn't give him back those days of liberty. So the only real meaningful option left is dismissal, and the government calls it the nuclear option. However, the nuclear option would be a situation like in Dunlap v. Convening Authority, where this court in 1974 found a presumption of prejudice for any post-trial processing delay over 90 days. It called it a bold step that was needed to rectify an issue, a constant constitutional violation by the government. That's not what we're calling for here. We're calling for a dismissal of this case because of the egregiousness of this delay, the unexplained nature of that delay, and the three separate assertions by appellant to have his constitutional rights vindicated.
Counsel, as a matter, again, of curiosity, what would a DD-214 look like if we set it aside?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I'll be very honest.
It wouldn't be honorable discharge, probably.
Your Honor, again, I'm not sure. I'm that would be a scenario where, you know, how those things are created in the ether, I don't know. But I can certainly supplement the record to answer Your Honor's question.
One last question is, your college uniform, the new military Army uniform?
It is, Your Honor, yes. We are very excited about the pinks and greens.
I read in the Charleston, South Carolina paper that the trainees at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, are going to be issued those for their graduation this year. It'll be the first time the line soldiers will get them. So that's interesting. I wondered what they look like. Thank you.
Should be a spiffy photo, sir. Pending any further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.